Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Upward Spiral, a music business podcast presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, I am talking with Russ Krupnik, who is the managing partner of Music Watch, a music and entertainment-focused market research firm. We are going to talk about how people consume music, where they get it from, and why it matters. I am Kyle Blinn, a user researcher at SoundHound, a music ID and search app. I am also the author of the book Promised Land, Youth Culture, Disruptive Startups, and the Social Music Revolution. As I said at the top of the show, I'm joined by Russ Krupnik. Say hello, Russ.
Hello, everyone.
To start off, tell me about how Music Watch came to be and what it is.
Well, I think most of your listeners might be familiar with Music Watch from its incarnation as an NPD service. We started NPD's entertainment practice tracking music right about the same time that Napster started, and over the years expanded that into a variety of entertainment research services looking at home video. We went from originally just looking at CDs to tracking digital music and then expanding into streaming. About a year ago, NPD decided to exit that business, and we at Music Watch just picked it up and have kept it going.
Who are some of those primary clients that you serve?
We work with record labels, we work with trade associations, we work with technology companies, streaming companies, we've worked with distributors over the years. You know, I think anyone who has an appetite for understanding the music consumer overall and what their activities are, anyone who has an appetite for understanding how what their share is or what their loyalty is compared to competition, how the market is growing. You know, I often explained it to people who didn't know much about consumer research that, you know, SoundScan, this was back in the day, SoundScan tracks what comes across the register. We try to understand the consumer that actually made that transaction originally at the store. Obviously, it's much more complex now.
And then what are some of those specific studies that you specialize in that you conduct and present to those clients?
We've always done artist profiling. So if somebody would like to understand awareness and likability and demographics and music engagement habits of their particular artist, we're one of the resources that they might use. We've done for well over a decade a variety of strategic studies that help understand consumption patterns. You know, back in the day, it really was all about acquiring and ownership and consumption and where people were doing it, you know, buying CDs at Tower Records. That evolved into understanding the whole ecosystem of digital downloads. And I think it was about 2006, 2007 that we started to look at streaming. And now, obviously, that's going to be most of our focus. In terms of streaming, we're the research company that I believe has been doing share of music listening in terms of how people are spending their time, in terms of hours, probably the longest of anyone. We look at customer satisfaction. We look at growth rates. We look at cross-usage, loyalty, demographics, pretty much, you know, all you'd need to know to get a basic understanding of what's going on in the streaming environment.
What has it been like watching the music industry change as well as the music consumer change since the emergence of Napster and the rise of the MP3?
Well, you know, one way to answer that, as a researcher, it used to be really simple, sort of the predecessor to what we're doing now was we would give people a deck of postcards and say every time that you bought a CD or even a cassette, you know, please fill it in and tell us that you bought it at Tower or Nobody Beats the Wiz or Walmart or Best Buy. Tell us, you know, why you bought it, what you paid for it, and, you know, send that back to us. And it was very simple. We could understand NSYNC buyers, where they were shopping, and who they were. The whole thing was just a whole lot more simple. I think now what's fascinating to me is, and equally difficult from a research standpoint, is the degree of complexity, the number of things that consumers are doing. When you took a look at a fan 20 years ago, well, you know, they bought a lot of CDs and they went to a lot of shows and maybe they had a t-shirt or two. You know, now that same fan, we have to understand their purchase patterns, because as I'm sure we'll get into, there are people who actually are still buying to own. We need to understand their listening habits. We need to understand their streaming preferences, the social component of the use of social media, and so on. So the degree of complexity, both in terms of what we offer as an industry to the consumer, what the consumer is doing, and trying to follow all of that, is just increased by magnitudes.
Absolutely. When you do these surveys, you have to cover so many grounds. What are the different sources of music you consume? Is it CDs? Is it vinyl? Is it MP3? Is it AM/FM radio? Is it internet radio? Is it streaming music? And then all the different mobile apps they use. And they have to start talking about different file sharing services. Like, there really is so much to take into consideration when you're looking at this.
Right. I mean, just your example of file sharing. I guess if you go back to the early days, it was, I'm either trading CDs with a friend, and that's assuming I had a CD burner in my computer, which I remember the time when that was, remember when you actually used to have to go out and buy a CD burner? And there was peer-to-peer. Now there are, probably a couple of dozen ways that, or flavors of how you can, let's say, share music. I'll leave piracy out of it, but just like every other, let's call them format, there's just so many more options. While the interesting thing is, it used to be that 90% of people bought CDs. I could walk down the street and basically say pretty much everybody who you passed by was a CD buyer. Now what's happened is, there's just so much more fragmentation in terms of all of these behaviors. Are you social with your music? And I don't mean just kind of seeing things on Facebook, but are you actively engaging? Are you a stream ripper? We've gone from vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry to the Howard Johnson, is it 26, 28 flavors of ice cream or more?
Something that I found fascinating during the whole Taylor Swift and Spotify debacle is, online you had this enormous conversation about what it meant that one of today's biggest pop artists was no longer carrying her music, including her newest album, on the largest music streaming service. And while all of this was happening, in the blogosphere on the internet, I was on Facebook and I saw a photo of my roughly 22-year-old cousin holding the brand new Taylor Swift album, excited as hell to finally have that music and to be able to listen to it. I just thought about it for a minute. It's like, what do I know? I'm reading a bunch of blogs on the internet about what's happening. Here's a real person who's really excited about Taylor Swift. She went and bought the CD and she doesn't seem upset at all.
No, I think one of the real misconceptions, and I want to preface this by saying, some of my colleagues have said, stop talking about these things because you sound like a Luddite, and tech companies won't want to talk with us. But I think one of the real misconceptions is that people don't buy things anymore, and B, especially younger people, that teens don't buy music. You bring up Taylor Swift. Just a couple of years ago, when you had a lot of very youth-oriented releases, Bieber, Lady Gaga, I think the earlier days of Taylor Swift, I'm talking maybe 2010, 2011, Eminem, there were a bunch of releases that were targeted to the younger audience. CD sales among teenagers went up by something like 20%. So there is still, and even in the streaming world, there is still an ownership ethos that exists. Is it what it was a decade ago? Absolutely not. But it's still there. And I would argue that it's still very strong. It kind of has to be the right content. I mean, an example of that at the other end of the tale is Adele. We saw tremendous uptake in both CD purchasing and adoption of digital downloads when 21 was released, because you had a lot of older consumers who said, hey, I like that. I want to have it. I want to own it. I want to listen to it repeatedly. So they went out and bought it.
Absolutely. And I think you're also seeing some of that with, the Frozen soundtrack had a lot of sales as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's another great example. Yes.
You mentioned the fact that teenagers buying music, especially physical music, is a misconception that people sometimes lose themselves on. What are some of the other big misconceptions today about how people consume music?
Well, let me just say, I think probably more people get it right than wrong. There's no question that when you look at listening habits, there is an increasing shift to streaming. As I mentioned, we've been looking at share of music listening for over 5 years. If I went back 5 years ago, over half of the music listening was coming from AM, FM, and CDs. If I take a look at that, in a recent study that we did in the fall, AM, FM is down to about 21% of our listening hours, and CD is down to about 10%. So I don't think that there's any question that, this movement to streaming is something that everybody's getting right. The one thing that just the counter to that is, if you read the blogs, you would think everybody's streaming. The reality is that there's still, and we look at the internet population for this, there's still roughly 100 million people in the internet population who aren't regular streamers. So there's a big population that is, but there's an equally big population that's not. You mentioned my write-up about piracy before. For some reason, piracy, we don't talk about that a lot, about that much anymore. Certainly the way that we did back in the Napster days, or when there was a lot of litigation. But as I wrote about in the recent blog, there's a lot of piracy, and it's not trivial. I was just looking just yesterday at some stream ripping numbers. That's the people who are going on to something like YouTube and ripping the audio track. The average stream ripper is taking the equivalent of about 2 albums per year. So I think to dismiss, let's call it sharing rather than piracy, would be something that we miss. And maybe the third thing is ownership. My guess is we're just tabulating our latest annual study. My guess is this year we'll probably see about 80 million people who bought music, be it a CD or a digital download. Now it's much less than in years past. But even so, tell me what streaming service wouldn't like to have an audience of 80 million active listeners. So, this ownership thing is waning, but it's still something that we can't take our eyes off. So those are a couple of the trends that we can talk about, but your listeners should probably be thinking about.
One thing that you brought up there that I thought was really interesting is that music piracy really doesn't dominate the conversation the way it once was. When I started blogging around 2008, 2009, that was such a strong part of the media narrative. And my small part in that conversation, I felt, was that I was one of the few 20-somethings who were blogging about the experience of growing up with music piracy and trying to make sense of how it came to be and sort of a part of my life and how it changed the way I, you know, listen to and discover music. After so many years of that being such a dominant part of the narrative, it has really died down. And that's why I found your blog post to be so timely, because this really isn't something that has gone away. And like you say, there are so many more mobile and online, quote unquote, ways to pirate music, whether you call it stream ripping or the various music downloader services on Android and iOS.
Right.
So what inspired you to kind of write that blog post and say, hey, you know, this is still important?
I guess it's something, you know, having been involved, but it's sort of an accident of timing, having gotten involved in the music industry just as Napster was kind of hitting its stride and being very involved in the tracking and trying to understand how people were using peer-to-peer services for illegal music downloading. It's, I guess you could say, it's always been one of my hobbies. And to your point, Kyle, the reality is that peer-to-peer, what you and I essentially grew up with as piracy, has diminished substantially. I think, you know, without quoting the stats, we could look at year-over-year trends in the number of files that are downloaded from peer-to-peer. They're declining at, you know, at double-digit rates. But what we see is other forms of sharing cropping up. And I do think what intrigued me is I'm not sure that folks necessarily understand or are clear in terms of what is a legal, sanctioned, reputable way to get music versus one that is not. You know, we all knew 15 years ago that if we had the only CD burner and we burned 10 copies and gave them to our friends, or worse still, we sold them, we knew that probably wasn't, you know, sanctioned behavior. But I think to your point, I can go on an app store and type in, you know, music downloads or songs and get something from a very legitimate place and, you know, put it on my phone or use that app on a computer. And maybe I'm not 100% sure that I see that Taylor Swift song that I can't get on Spotify, but I can get it in some of these places. And there's no kind of good housekeeping warning, if you will.
For many years, GrooveShark has been a shining example of that. I've encountered several people when I ask them, well, how do you listen to music? And they say, well, I use GrooveShark. And I find it really interesting because after, you know, some conversing, I sort of say, like, well, the situation around GrooveShark is kind of complicated. They don't exactly pay all their royalties. They're not necessarily a legal music service. And you can just kind of see like their eyes glaze over because it's, you know, because they're using it. It's there. It's solving whatever problem they need to be solved. And it looks like a legal music service.
I think, and not to drift off into another place, I think one thing that we, again, going back to the blogosphere or, you know, people who are sitting in conference rooms or even going to music conferences, I think that one thing that we've always got to keep in mind is, you know, 90% of the people, and I mean this as a hard number because we do research into it, 90% of the people aren't tuned in to what all of these nuances necessarily are. So, you know, it may just, either their eyes are glazing over or they don't, they're just simply not aware or they've never been educated or, you know, probably a few of them don't care. But I think it's, we have to understand the audience that some of these messages go out to. And I actually think that not only impacts, you know, messaging, leave piracy aside for a second, although I'd welcome coming back to it. I think that understanding who the real music consumer is or who most of the music fans are, is very helpful, not only with regard to piracy, but it's helpful with regard to understanding how to position music services. You know, the majority of people aren't necessarily interested. They're interested in listening to music more so than necessarily being very, very social about their music. And to me, this conversation also drifts into, you know, understanding eventually how do you get people to pay for subscriptions. The assumption that just because you drop price, for example, that everybody's going to come and subscribe sort of misses the point about who the average music consumer is. So I guess what I'm trying to do is, you know, tying together piracy, how you position services, how you monetize music. I think it's really important to understand that there is a subgroup of consumers who are really tuned into these things, but you know, the average person on the street probably isn't.
So you brought up two very interesting points there. The first being something I believe we talked about before, which is this idea that you're not sure that people understand who the customer is and what drives them. The second thing that you said is this common held belief that if the price of subscription music is lowered, it would broaden the appeal of the service because it would make it kind of more affordable for people who only spend roughly, what, $50 to $60 a year on music. First, let's just touch on that first statement, which is, does the music industry know or understand who their customer is?
At one level, yes, I think that they do. I think they have a very good understanding of who their customer is. I'm going to say the music industry broadly. I think that they understand through a lot of research that they do with companies like ourselves, other kinds of research, understanding what's happening in the spheres of social media. So to say that the music industry is not educated about the consumer would probably be a misstatement. What I think happens sometimes, I had this conversation, I put it this way to a streaming company. Sometimes the engineers get to run things. And you start thinking, well, if we could just engineer this, or if we could just create this kind of a capability, that consumers would come flocking towards it. And there's a long history in the music business of, or at least in the past few years, of that not necessarily being successful. It goes all the way back to, boy, we did tests on all kinds of connected CDs that would be hybrid with digital. Consumers weren't interested in that. So from a physical standpoint, I think there's this hope that if we could sometimes we could just engineer our way out of this. And sometimes consumers are just looking for a simple solution and just want to listen to music that they like.
The way that I've always described this is the fanatic fallacy, which is that, you know, startup founders and music technologists mispredict how vast the chasm is between them and regular people, and that even if they build a solution that kind of fits their needs, that doesn't mean they've solved a problem that the wider market cares about.
I mean, I'll give you two examples. A few years ago, the industry put a lot of effort into high definition discs. I don't, you know, the actual title of them escapes me. But it was essentially, you know, a higher sound quality disc. It didn't appeal to virtually nobody. We've talked a lot about some of the streaming services that are all based upon sound quality. And, you know, those haven't gotten traction because most consumers have said, hey, I think the sound quality on what I'm listening to is pretty good already. So, you know, you said it very, very much more eloquently than I did. I do think there is that disconnect between engineering and product development and the consumer sometimes.
And the sort of death pool of music startups can sometimes be a testament to that.
Oh, yes. I mean, I don't know how many meetings I've had at CES with folks who, again, it just don't seem to have a grasp of where the market really is, or, you know, they're kind of targeting that top 1%. And, you know, I don't think there's a business there.
There was a blog post that came out a few months ago where a user researcher at a leading tech company essentially said, like, look, San Francisco is not a good place to research your customers because the customers here are unlike the customers in the rest of the country. And you're only biasing yourselves further by believing that, well, everyone in San Francisco wanted my product, therefore the rest of the world must want it. And I think, you know, beyond technological solutions, music can be a tricky bag because those who are passionate about music and the specific things that they want from their experience don't necessarily translate into things that are valuable to casual listeners, people who, you know, are still listening to a variety of broadcast radio, who still have some owned music, and, you know, for the most part, either looking up a song on YouTube or a custom station on Pandora is amazing to them. It is the future of music. It's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think at some point I have a comment and a story for you, a quick story. My comment to that is sometimes I wonder if the music industry has to decide you want to cater to that top 10%. Now, they're really important. That top 10% probably accounts for, you know, half of the music spend in terms of subscriptions and CDs and downloads. Do you want to cater to them? Or do you want a business like what the business used to be? Again, the Luddite label may come in, where you had 90% of people participating. I think probably most people would agree. Leaving broadcast radio aside, I'd much rather see an industry where 90% of people are monetized, and then figure out, you know, then you can segment from there. But I do worry that increasingly or often that casual listener is forgotten. And here's what's, and I'm not an advertising expert. Here's what interests me also about that casual user. 20 years ago, you could make the argument, why should we target the casual user? They don't buy CDs, or they buy one per year. And as a marketing guy, I would say that's brilliant. You know, why you wouldn't target them. It's going to be very expensive. If you go into a streaming world, my ears as a casual user, my attention as a casual user has the potential to be just as valuable as a super uber fan engaged person, because if I'm a, there are a lot of streamers who are over the age of 45. They have mortgages, they have insurance, they need car tires, they go out to eat. It's about advertising more than it is about selling them goods. So to some extent, the casual fan's ear, the casual fan, the value of that ear can be just as good as or if not better than the value of a super engaged fan. Not with concerts, not with merchandise, not with, necessarily with subscriptions or downloads, but certainly from an advertiser perspective, they could be very highly valuable.
Another thing that we kind of touched on about who the music consumer is and what they want. You know, first we were talking about the San Francisco market and how that could be kind of biased towards technology adoption. Move Music used to be a subsidiary of Cricket Wireless. They were recently acquired by Deezer, but at their height, they had something like 2 million subscribers in the US. And when I would talk to my friends in Los Angeles about, you know, wow, you know, the largest music subscription service in the US is something I've never seen or seen anyone use. And I always kind of think about it for a second, then I'd explain to people, well, that's because we're not of a sort of, we're of a higher class demographic, right? Like, if we went to other neighborhoods in Los Angeles, possibly poorer neighborhoods, more racially diverse, we might find people who are actually using Move Music and is a part of their music experience. And that audience of people is significantly larger and broader than us who are consuming music on Spotify and Pandora and RDO.
I did a focus group. This was the story, and I'll try to make it quick. I did a focus group a few years ago for the Music Business Association. Some people more familiar with it as NARM. And we purposely did it in Chicago, we did it in New Jersey, but we went to Tulsa, Oklahoma. And two things stuck out. When I had a group, one of the focus groups that I moderated was, maybe 40-something-year-olds. Of that focus group of eight people, three or four of them were ministers or had very strong religious beliefs. And surprising to me, they even thought that legal downloading, the iTunes model, should be discouraged because it might lead to stealing music. So that any digital activity might lead to piracy, which given their religious convictions, they clearly were against. I then did a group of college students. I think University of Oklahoma is nearby, and was asking them about spending patterns and so on and so forth. All of these kids had jobs at Walmart or McDonald's. They weren't like my kids who were, bless my kids, we were able to help them with college. They had a car. We could help them with gas. We made sure that they had iPods and iPads and Macs and so on. These kids, when you ask them about buying music, for them, it was a decision between, do I put gas in my car to get to my class tonight, or do I spend $10 on that album? And for me, both of those stories kind of illustrate how different consumers can be. So I always tell people, if you really want to understand consumers, you have to go to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Right? And I do think, without... without getting way off of my sweet spot, we see this in the research, the values, the wants, the needs, where they shop, their ability to pay for things, all very, very different. Again, it kind of brings around that circle of how important it is to understand different consumer groups. Because look from a streaming perspective, we've got half the customers right now. You could argue whether they're using the right services or spending enough time or spending enough money on subscriptions, that different argument. We've got half of them right now. The next half are not going to be so easy because their listening hours, their music hours are less, their level of engagement is less. But for streaming to reach its full potential, we're going to have to figure out as an industry, how do you get that focus group that was half ministers and at the time thought digital, had the potential to lead to some bad behaviors. How do you convince them to start using some of the services, the great services that are out there?
One of the things my dad said to me that I thought was interesting, which was a story, is, my dad must be, almost 60 years old. He's been working in the same area for most of his life. And several of his new friends started buying cars. And with those brand new cars came Sirius XM radio. And he was saying, Kyle, some of my stingiest friends, the people who would hold on to a penny after spending a year with Sirius XM satellite radio, they kept subscribing and they loved it. And he's like, Kyle, this amazes me because, this is something that has been around for, 10 years. But once it was actually in the car as a part of the experience and they had it for a year, they didn't want to let it go. And I think that is kind of like a great illustration of like how long it takes a technology to truly reach the mainstream. And I would consider, you know, satellite radio something that has gone mainstream already, you know?
Yeah, I would agree by the technical graduate school definition, mainstream. But still, and not to be a hater, I think there, you know, there's somewhere around 20 million in terms of domestic subscriptions, give or take, which means that you've still got 80 million households, and I'll put it on a household basis, since, you know, maybe we share the car, we share the subscription. You know, you've still got a really long way to go, even with something like satellite radio, which you cannot make music any easier. Subscription music, you get a free trial. It's integrated in your car. As a user, I will tell you it works very well. And as a listener, for me, it's a first class experience. So, you know, they hit on bad, you know, analogy. They hit on all eight cylinders. But still, there's an awful lot more potential. I actually think I think that the car is going to be the tipping point for a lot of this, because for a couple of reasons. I think about 65% of CD listening relates to the car, maybe a little bit more, but certainly around two-thirds. And when people say to me, why do folks still buy CDs? It's really simple, because they still have CD players in cars. So a lot of CD listening is happening in the car. Obviously, a lot of radio listening is happening in the car. More and more people are learning how to connect in the car, if not directly through an informatic system, through an audio cable. And you know, the research says that there's some pent up demand for that. So I think once the consumer kind of starts to figure out how to do that a little bit more, once the technology gets a little bit better, the services, I would argue, are really great. Take your pick. I don't, you know, whether you like Sirius or whether you like Pandora or Spotify or audio, that to me is when things are really going to take off.
Which do you think is going to play a bigger role in that tipping point, the infotainment center with Spotify directly plugged in free for a year, or a seamless experience of plugging in your smartphone and it instantly bringing it up on the dash and playing?
I think it depends upon what we're talking about. If we're talking about getting people to pay for subscriptions, it may very well have to model itself after the Sirius XM model. It's built into the dash. It's really easy to use. I get a free trial for a while, et cetera, et cetera. There's no the mobile side of things. Is just sort of an artifact that I think something like 50% of smartphone users are using their phone to listen to music. So the fact that some of them have figured out how to connect it in the car is just an extension of how they're increasingly listening to music. It's funny, you know, if I was looking at research from a few years ago. Shocking how many people were listening to iPod music on iPods. 2004, 2005. I mean, iPods were huge in terms of music listening. Now that's happening on the smartphone. So I think what's happening in the car is just a natural extension of how folks want to listen to music. I think to actually monetize it, you are going to need that dashboard. You probably are going to need some free trials or some hardware bundling and so on.
It's interesting how far along things have come. I also remember listening to my iPod in the car. You had that dongle thing that you attached to the top of the iPod. You tuned it to the correct radio station. And it kind of sort of worked if you picked a radio station that didn't also have a dominant frequency. You know, mm-hmm. Now, which almost seems like 10 years later, probably is. I do have a newer car. It does have the USB. I plug it right in. It picks up, you know, what music is playing on my phone, and it just starts playing through the stereo. I don't really have to think about it.
Right. I do, you know, just to kind of take one step back and not to cast a cloud over this, I think if I was looking at some data recently, I think for some of the major services, about 10% of our respondents said that they're kind of using those services regularly in the car. So I just wonder if the progression is first, you know, first I have to convince somebody that streaming is a good thing. Because look, you're up against you know, a lot of folks who are still listening to CDs. You're up against broadcast radio for music listening, which, you know, we'd all say wasn't as good as, quote, back in the day, but it's still very easy and it's very powerful. And frankly, you're also up against what's an interesting thing about mobile and smartphones. We're actually, even though download sales are declining, we're actually seeing a little bit of an uptick in the number of hours that people are spending listening to their digital downloads. I think it's because a lot of folks have ported them onto their iPhone. So my point is, I think when we talk about the car, it's probably an issue of first getting people to really understand why do I need, what's the benefit of streaming in the first place? I don't know if Sirius had the same, you know, kind of a curious question, whether Sirius had the same challenge is, you know, why should I listen to this? Well, the answer was pretty simple. I have really, really highly curated music. If I want, I can listen to CNN. There's weather, there's sports, you know, so.
Well, I mean, you also have to just consider that people in rural areas, if they commute, you know, 45 miles to work or go to a distant town, they can't tune into the same radio station. So the idea that they can tune into a station and then keep it on for the perpetuity of their entire trip is a new idea.
Yes, but we're not quite there yet. As somebody who drives up to New York, upstate periodically, you know, when you go through the hills, you get an awful lot of buffering. So, I think we've got a little bit ways to go before the streaming experience is entirely optimized in the car. But you know, I think if you and I are having this conversation 5 years from now, that's simply just not going to be an issue.
So, what about this topic of price? You told that anecdote of being in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and this college student telling you, you know, Russ, I have to choose between putting gas in my car or buying the new CD or eating tonight. And your suggestion was that, you know, I don't know if lowering the price of streaming music is going to get this customer in the door. So what people always say is that, look, subscription music at the highest tier costs $120 per year, which is more than half of what the average consumer spends on music. Why wouldn't lowering it closer to that $50 or $60 range make it more accessible for a wider market?
I hear that argument all the time. And sometimes somebody once told me, just because you can put, you know, popcorn together with laundry detergent in a research analysis doesn't necessarily mean they belong together or they correlate. They just happen to be in the same. You can make a market share out of them. The reality is, I think you have to examine why did people spend $120 back in the CD days? Well, people had particular favorite artists that they wanted to listen to repeatedly. You couldn't do that. You know, you'd have to listen to the radio all day to hear it over and over and over again. And for most of us, right? Because the truth is that piracy was a minority behavior. For most of us, the only option was to go out and was to spend that $120. So I think using the past, using the spending of the past as a benchmark is sort of a misleading argument, because the circumstances were very different in the year 2000 than they are in the year 2015. I think the research overwhelmingly shows there are people, it shows, I'll give you two things. There are people who have what I call a subscription ethos. If I look at people who subscribe to Spotify, for example, I can predict that they're going to subscribe, much more likely to subscribe to Amazon Prime, much more likely to subscribe to Netflix, much more likely to subscribe to HBO and Showtime. You have a relatively small group of people who have bought into the whole idea of, I want premium content and I'm willing to pay premium dollars to get that content delivered how and when that I want. That's a very small group of people at this point. Right? I mean, what does Netflix have domestically? You know, 30 million? You know, and that's the biggest model that we could probably point to. So I think the idea that just because we lower the price, hordes of folks are going to come into the subscription, buy into subscription. I'm not sure that there's necessarily evidence to support that. And as I said, I don't think comparing it to an out-of-date model or the legacy model, I don't think it's necessarily a helpful argument. The other thing I'll tell you is we ask people all the time. So you subscribe to, or you use one of the free services. What would get you to pay? More than half the people say nothing at all. Not lowering prices, not ad-free, not a higher quality sound experience, not more devices. I mean, whatever, you know, all of the things we've probably spoken about. So the reality is that at least at the moment, the majority of people are saying, I don't really care what you do from an engineering standpoint. I'm not interested in paying. So if you tie all of these things together, I bristle at the argument that if we just drop streaming to $4.99 or $2.99, we're going to have as many people paying for streaming and paying as much for streaming as we used to have in the heyday of CD sales. The evidence just doesn't support it.
Anyone that I would ask would probably say something similar, which is that, hey, like, I don't want to pay anything at all. Like, I understand that music should be free. It's always been free as far as I'm concerned, and I'm not going to pay money for it.
Now that said, you know, one thing that I have to say about, because I also spent many years doing similar kinds of research in home video. Look, the reason that I had to subscribe to Netflix is, if I wanted to watch Breaking Bad, which I didn't watch the first time around, I didn't watch the first few seasons. When I finally got my Breaking Bad addiction, the only option that I had was to pay Netflix $8 or $9 a month, or else I couldn't play. There was scarcity. The home video, the studios did a reasonably good job of creating scarcity. And still do. I could rent it for $3.99. I could buy it, you know, through electronic sell-through, a digital copy for, let's say, about $15. But except if I went to the torrents, which most of us aren't going to do, I couldn't watch Breaking Bad for quote-unquote free, although, you know, the free services are ad-supported. So, you know, I think that's one of the things that, unless the industry is willing to take a really sharp left turn and recreate the scarcity of, you know, the 1990s, what your friends are telling you is kind of the reality, I think.
Another anecdote that I think plays into this very well is, I had a friend of mine, several friends of mine, try out the Beats Music service who'd never really seen or used it before. Because I wanted to interview them for the podcast, and it was incredibly revealing. After one of the interviews concluded, you know, I spent maybe 35 minutes talking to my friend about his experience at the Beats Music Service, whether he liked the playlists, and whether or not he can consider paying for the service. And then I finally just said to like, okay, so wait, haven't you used Spotify before? And this is a 28-year-old, very smart graduate student of engineering. He said, you know, I've been meaning to check it out. I just haven't got around to it yet. And I'm thinking in my head, it's like, oh, checking out Spotify is on the to-do list in your head that never gets done. That's where it sits in priority for you. And he's a huge music fan, huge Tool fan. And I found that so kind of mind-blowing and extraordinary.
Right. Well, you know, just sort of run the numbers a little bit. Leaving YouTube aside, because I will tell you from a music perspective, it's a horse race. So when I say what I'm about to say, you could apply the same thing to YouTube, YouTube and Vivo. If Pandora's got in the U.S., let's just round it to 70 million active users. And active is a big, you know, that not necessarily somebody who's using it in the past week or the past month. That's roughly, just roughly one third of the internet population, right? One third. And Pandora is by far the service that has the highest awareness and the highest usage. And it's only got a third. Imagine what those numbers look like when you start to think about some of the other services. Now, on demand is growing. Spotify is growing. You know, could it be as big as Pandora? Sure. So this isn't a criticism of any particular service. It's just pointing out that most of these services, I mean, that's why I thought Taylor Swift did them a really, really big favor. If you ask the average person what a Spotify is, they would probably not know. They wouldn't know. Spotify's awareness is less than 50%. So I think the reality is your friend is not all that unusual. We think everybody's streaming, everybody's using Spotify, everybody's creating playlists. We have a ways to go. We'll get there, but we have a ways to go until we are there as an industry.
Well said. So, Russ, we've covered a wide range of topics on the show today. Is there anything else in your mind that you'd like to share?
No, I've very much enjoyed the time. I'm sure we could squeeze in another hour or two at some point, and I hope that we do.
If people want to look you and Music Watch up online, where can they find you?
Certainly. Our website is musicwatchinc.com. You have to add that INC at the end of Music Watch. And this is a description of our services, some contact information, some of our recent blogs and PR is up there. And they can certainly feel free to reach out to me for business or more conversation.
That's all for this episode of The Upward Spiral. Thanks to Hypebot.com for helping to put this podcast out. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com and be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. And don't forget to subscribe at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please rate us highly and submit a review. Thank you for listening.